Greetings, this is James Gillen with World Pooja. I'm your host, and we've got another great show today. We've got Neil Kramer, and he's an English writer, philosopher, and teacher specializing in the fields of consciousness, metaphysics, and mysticism. He speaks only on fascinating subjects and is renowned for his unique blend of lucidity, empowerment, and authenticity. His new book, The Unfoldment, is it now in the bookstores, and without any further ado, I want to welcome Neil on the show. Neil, are you with us?
I am. Nice to be here, James. How are you doing?
Oh, yeah, doing great. Hey, we miss you up here.
Oh, well, I'll be back soon for the summer conference, so I'll see you guys again.
Great. Yeah, the 29th, the 30th, so everybody put that on your calendar.
Absolutely. We'll mention that again later.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Skywatches aren't the same without you out here, and with a nice cigar smell in the air. And
don't give away all my secrets. I know. Well, it's funny. It's coming to that time of year again where we can stand out, you know, to 9, 10, 11, 12 o'clock and not freeze our you-know-whats off.
Yeah, definitely. I know that what you wanted to talk about today was breaching the narrative self, and I think that's a great title. And maybe for the listening audience, maybe you can kind of explain that a little bit and where we're trying to go with that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I thought was a good idea was obviously when you're talking about a new book or DVD or something, you want to try and shake it up a bit for the listeners to make sure that you're not keep kind of saying the same thing over and over. So what I've tried to do, as I've done various interviews with people on the subject of the book, is try and bring out different elements of it. So one of the elements that I think is very pertinent to myself, to lots of people who are working on, you know, their own spiritual development and so on, is this idea that we have a life narrative, which is you know, being Neil Kramer or being James Gilliland. And in your narrative, you get very used to the sort of script that you tend to follow, like your speech patterns, what you wear, what you eat, who you talk to, what you like, what you don't like. And over a number of years, particularly when you as you mature in your 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, that script becomes very kind of dense. And it's almost like, I say, it's like a sort of actor who forgets for a while that he is an actor, and he becomes so absorbed into the role of playing this person that you forget that you're on a film set and it's illusory and there's actually someone else behind the character, so to speak. And I find it very much the same in real life. And sometimes, and I mean, you'll know this through your own spiritual work, that narrative of being oneself, so to speak, playing oneself, gets in the way of channeling higher consciousness and of making contact with a different order of reality. So one of the techniques I've kind of learned to adopt, and one of the philosophies behind this, is when, particularly when I work with people on a teaching level, and again, I know you'll appreciate this from your work, but people want the techniques, but they also want the reasoning behind it. And I've found that the people who have the most trouble with kind of spiritual contact or contact with other types of dimensions, shall we say, 4 and 5D densities and dimensions, are people who have a very thick life narrative with lots of issues and lots of dramas, some of them good things, not all negative, some of them quite interesting, and you know, they're full of travel and restaurants and gourmet food and wines and holidays and vacations and kids and baseball and school runs and goodness knows what, and the narrative of life is so full with these doings that it fills up all the sort of bandwidth for anything else to occur. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of a unique problem in today's world, because if we go back to some of our spiritual heritage of, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism and Mithraism and Wicca and Druidism, you find that it was a very different kind of world, and time worked in a different way. So although people still had to work, their leisure time wasn't sponged up with all this other stuff. There was contemplative time, and that's kind of gone today. So I often find when I work with people, and even in workshops and presentations to some extent, you have to outline that fact to say, if you are very much anchored in your narrative, and as I say, however positive or negative that is, you have to realize that it's a choice that you've chosen that. So whether you're, married with 10 kids and you're just busy, 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 or whether you're a sort of solitary, wandering spirit hovering in the forest, you choose that lifestyle, and there's some important lessons in that. But whatever that narrative is, you have to create a space for the spiritual work to take place. And I think that's one of the things why people value going to other people who have created a space. And obviously, you guys are a very good example of that, where you've not only created it, but you actively hold that space for other people to come. So, yeah, they want to see James and they want to see Nate and Jana and all the other guys and stuff. But fundamentally, I think it's the space that is held that is one of the primary things that brings people to vortices and spiritual centers. And the land, of course, plays its role in that. But I think people, when they go back from that, and I can speak from my own experience, when I've gone back into the city, or when I go back to Los Angeles, or if I go to Seattle, or I was in San Francisco and New York recently, the kind of space is an altogether different challenge when you're in an urban environment and when you're surrounded by human culture. And again, not bad culture, movies and art and theater and so on, but it absolutely creates this incredible static that it's very difficult to pierce, if you want to do some work, if you do some spiritual development. And of course, anyone who's interested in telekinesis or telepathy or channeling or whatever, that finer skill is really, really difficult in a thick, rich narrative that is, essentially being piped to people from the television and the magazines and the billboards and what have you. So, I mean, from my personal experiences that having spent some time over in your neck of the woods, rented a house out there, written my book out there in this pristine, lovely environment, and then coming over to Portland to live recently. I mean, I love Portland, it's great, but what a challenge, what a fascinating challenge that is. And I kind of enjoy that contrast, but it's teaching me what I teach other people, which is how to create that space for yourself. It's great going to a teacher and having them do it for you, but there comes a point where you need to learn to start creating that sacred space for yourself. And, as I say, I'm sure you understand that, and you must come across that in your work too.
Yeah, like a, it seems like the psychic turbulence, of the city when I go even in Hood River, it's a beautiful little town, but I feel drained energetically, and it's kind of interesting. It's like a frog in the pot, you stay there too long and you kind of get absorbed by it, and so as you're saying, you have to really learn wherever you are to create that sacred space, and to find ways of blocking out the psychic turbulence, and just really getting centered in, into your own higher self, not your, I guess, the personality and body that people are so wrapped up in.
Yeah, I think part of the success of that is moving around a bit as well, getting a bit of diversity in your environment. Like today, I live kind of, right about a mile away from Powell's Bookshop, which is very much downtown Portland. But 2 minutes walk away is like a big park, Washington Park, which is like, I've got a lot of green space and rose garden and Japanese and a Zen garden. And if you go early in the morning or later in the evening, there's not a lot of people there as well, so you can get a bit of, kind of quality time there. And that's been essential for me to have that kind of level of balance, because you can always hop in the car and go to various woods and forests in Oregon, because we're very blessed with them, as you guys are in Washington State. There's a lot of green here in the Pacific Northwest, but it's nice just to walk out of the door, put your shoes on and walk to it sometimes. So I think if I was living in Manhattan, that's an altogether different thing. I mean, you've got Central Park, but it's not quite the same because it is literally surrounded by, you know, concrete and glass and chrome and steel, and that does interfere with the signal to some extent. So yeah, I mean, this idea of breaching the narrative of self is also about understanding the choices you make in your life, and understanding that if you have encumbered yourself to some extent with a lot of responsibilities and stuff, that might not be a bad thing, because it's showing you something important about people and, you know, children and relationships and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and stuff. But it is difficult to get away from the observance that you have to create space in your life for spiritual work. And that's one of the simplest and yet most common things that I come across in my teaching work, to say to people, what kind of space do you create for yourself on a weekly and a monthly basis? You know, ... And usually they sort of look at me to say, well, you know, not a lot really. You know, that's one of the things I'm trying to work towards. And I think it's foundational, that. And that's why in times gone by, people would go to monasteries and temples and hermitages and go on vision quests and stuff to make the move away from group consciousness and to go somewhere where that stops and that slows down. And I think it can be another kind of challenge to completely do that. And again, lots of people I know, and yourself, I know that for a fact now, we know people who have totally taken themselves away on, you know, silent retreats for extended periods of time. So one of the guys who's with you has spent time in a monastery on, you know, some serious quiet time retreat, you know, discipline, focus and stuff, away from normal society. That presents its own challenges, because if that period of time comes to an end naturally, you find yourself having to reintegrate back into the world. And if you've got used to being in a pristine environment with no distractions and no kind of nonsense, you know, what do? Can you not do that anymore? Can you not go into the city anymore? Do you say, well, I can't do that anymore? Or do you develop skills for it, or what? So that's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's shields up time, you know. It's interesting. I know people come here and they go through the transpersonal release sessions and things like that, and they have just an incredible breakthrough. And you know, and then they stay on the ranch for a while, and their whole frequency is altered and changed, and then they have to go back to work. And I always tell people, why don't you just hang out for an hour or two, walk around the land, ground this energy, get real grounded in it before you get in your car and drive and go down to Walmart, you know, for the blue light special, and get trampled by, you know, the energies there, you know.
And
it is important that, you know, a lot of times people don't even know how much psychic turbulence is in their life until they step out of it.
Yeah, and I think that busyness is a problem as well, because obviously people who might detract from you know, detractors of the spiritual way of life would say, well, you know, you're just a bunch of hippies lying around and, you know, being unproductive. And yet, you know, the busiest time in my life is now, in a way, you know, and I've not worked harder and deeper and gone through so many challenges. It's, you know, it's far busier than when I was in the business world. Yeah. And it's far more integrated, because there's no distinct cutoff. I mean, I can always go to, you know, my room and have a bath and all the rest of it like anyone else, but it seeps into every part of your life, because it's not like, you know, we're selling insurance and we know it's nonsense, then you come away. When you're doing work on spirituality and consciousness and philosophy and the esoteric, it's part of everything. It's part of your social network, it's part of your dreams, it's part of your conversation, it's part of your own personal meditation time. So again, one of the things that I often share with people is, don't think that being busy all the time is a good thing. Sometimes there are periods of that, like, you know, if you're writing books and doing conferences and doing films and so on. Even if you're leading this very kind of self-creating life, or if you're a graphic designer or a musician or something, and you're thinking, wow, you know, that's an interesting thing to do, there are going to be periods of busyness and productivity and labor. But it's very important, I think, and it's almost like an extra responsibility to say, look, I'm not doing my work properly if I don't create periods of space where nothing needs to be done, And that is a funny thing in this world, isn't it? Because it goes against that sort of Protestant work ethic that we grew up with from our mums and dads. You know, we have to unlearn that productivity is something that you can't always see, and it's something internal, really. And the fact that there isn't necessarily a distinct product or service in your hand that you're offering to somebody, that's something you've got to get to come to grips with personally. You know, because I know you worked in the commercial world as well in a previous incarnation, so you appreciate the contrast between the two. And it, even in this line of work, shall we say, that we do in our own ways now, I have to make a conscious effort to create time and space. Otherwise, you know, my narrative would just whip up into a constant thing of doing stuff. And although it looks very productive, and other people could say, you know, gosh, he's a busy guy, he's always doing stuff, you know, that looks good. But if I'm always busy, I think that's irresponsible.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah. And that's one of my things, too. And it's funny, at the ranch here, we've been working on that where, you know, we're kind of driven by our, you know, we really want to get things done and serve in the highest and best way and things like that. And the workload's just overwhelming sometimes for all of us here. And we've been talking a lot about that. And finally, we're doing it. And all of us are just saying, okay, enough. We need to go back to balance. We need to not take on the world right now, the world's problem. We have to set some time aside for ourselves. And some of us are actually going off and doing our own little retreats and spending, you know, a couple days away, totally away from the ranch.
Yeah, that's very healthy. That's
yeah, and,
a good thing.
And as beautiful as this place is and pristine with all the awesome things happening here, myself, I want to get out of Dodge every once in a while and go somewhere where nobody knows me. And,
yeah,
and nobody's standing outside my door waiting for me to walk out
yeah, that's right.
Or, you know, needing to tell me their story. And you know, it's just, you know, time where I can just be out in nature and go to places where you know, nobody knows me, which is why I sneak down to Mexico every once in a while during the
yeah.
winter.
No, I totally get that, and I enjoy that as well, where I can just do whatever and I'm not having to do anything or be anything or say anything or look a certain way or be a certain sort of resonance. You just think, well, I have to be able to do nothing. But that's part of my discipline, is to be able to create an environment and structure my life in such a way, conscientiously, I don't just mean be a total slacker or whatever, conscientiously create space where there is no agenda. There is consciously no agenda. And I think that's become increasingly important for me, because if I get too busy, the space that I hold for other people in working, you know, on a teaching basis and giving people guidance and inspiration and techniques and sharing spiritual wisdom, if I'm busy all the time, my power, if you like, on that level diminishes. So I have to make sure that every waking minute is not filled with doing. However brilliant that doing is, you know, like I say, it can look really good on the outside, like, wow, you know, you've put 10 books out and 50 DVDs and you're doing 100, you know, gigs or whatever. But that's not the game I'm playing. The game I'm playing is acknowledging that part of the teaching work, and this goes for me as well when I'm being taught by other people and by nature and by the universe, takes place on an unspoken, non-verbal, energetic level, and it's just proximity. So a number of people who I work with say, you know, it was great, some of the things we talked about, and I enjoyed the discourse, and it's nice to talk on that level, but just proximity to balanced energy in itself is very healing.
Yeah, I've got. I know one thing in the Tibetan Foundation, which also seemed to be another life when I was involved with that. They talk about an energy body, and it's kind of like a battery. And when you're giving, you're doing the spiritual work. It's like your batteries. You know, you're actually giving, and your batteries are being drained. And so you have to take time to replenish your batteries, which is quiet time, or you need to go eat and get grounded and get out in nature. There's a lot of different ways of replenishing your batteries. And
Yeah,
then,
yeah.
yeah, and there's another rule of thumb where people say, well, if you're working with the highest beings, you're never going to get tired, and you'll have endless energy and everything else. I just have never seen that. I've seen people with a lot of energy that are operating, on a personality level that say all the right buzzwords, but I know when you're really doing the work and you're really engaging a group or whatever, you get real high doing it and you have all this energy running through you, but then afterwards you need to go chill out for a little while.
You do, definitely. And I feel exactly the same when I have worked with an individual or a group. Like you say, when you're in the middle of it, you feel this channel of energy and you think, wow, this is great. I'm kind of like, an electric current. It's really, really good and it flows and you feel strong. For me, though, the mark of success, to some degree, of how well I've done and performed, if you like, and how integral it's been as part of me as Neil Kramer and me as a channel for something a bit higher than that, and a conduit for authentic people to express and share. For me, the success marker for that is afterwards, I should be kind of pretty exhausted in a way, in a nice way, like if you've done a good hard day's work and you kind of, you eat your food at dinner time and it tastes a bit better than normal. And when you sleep, your bed is a bit more delicious and wonderful than normal, and you just think, wow, sleep is amazing. And I think that ebb and flow of energy and power is very normal. And I know you and I have discussed food is a very good way of doing it sometimes. And you can't be messing about with a few soggy noodles. You might need a big, chunky, rare steak, to absolutely pull you into the physical, visceral experience of being a person, an animal, flesh and blood. So you have to bring it back down to the 3D if you're operating in the four and five sometimes.
Yeah, I found out that I love this one teacher. She said spiritual people are of no earthly good, and I started laughing when she said that. And then I said, "Wait a second, I got to figure this one out," and I realized if you're not grounded, you really can't bring in the energy if you're not grounded. And what good are you if you're always out in spirit? What good are you, in helping others here on earth if you're out in 5 or 6D? All the time. So I guess there seems to be a need of a balance,
There is,
between
and
the two worlds.
that's I guess the sort of art of the shaman, isn't it? That it's somebody who can bridge the two worlds and do it in a balanced way. It's no use being off your head all the time on ayahuasca or mushrooms or something. It's like, well done. You've got the sort of guts and the wherewithal to do that and try that and build that into your life. But as well as creating a dependency on a chemical for your projection skills, which isn't brilliant, it also falsely puts your power in a place where you don't naturally reside. Although we have a higher self presence in seven spaces, as you know, that I feel, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7D, our current resonance, our consistent residence, is in the third density realm for a reason. And that's because understanding polarity here, the negative, the shadow, the positive, the light, there's no better way of doing that than being a flesh and blood animal, because you can't really get out of it. You can't ignore it. So even with other teachers who shall remain nameless, occasionally when I've worked with other people, advanced spiritual practitioners, I've noticed that you can almost develop an unhealthy dependence on getting out of the 3D, particularly when it's challenging. So even for spiritual people, it's kind of like, you've got to watch the bottle. You know what I mean? You've got to make sure that you don't go to that juice and that skill and that projection ability just because you can do it, because it is easier out there. And like I say, if you've had a challenging time, and goodness knows 2012 has certainly been that for many, many people right now, including myself, if you've had a challenging time and you know that there's a lot of abundance of bliss and joy and equilibrium in the higher realms, shall we call them, then, boy oh boy, it's certainly very tempting to say, to be honest, I just want to be there. This is too weird and difficult. And if you're constantly doing that, then it's not the worst crime in the world, but you knock yourself out of balance. And I think it's significant if you incarnate as a 3D entity, which, you know, that's what we're talking about here. There's a reason for that, and it's not just the obvious things. It's because this offers a sort of pivot point, you know, like a fulcrum of balance to say, well, if you can lead a principled, high conduct, sincere existence as a flesh and blood animal, and you can develop your spiritual aspect at the same time, you will learn balance. You have to, as a human being. That's kind of what half the game is about, is learning balance. Because as well as what we talk about in our you know, in what you and I do in our books and DVDs and teachings, we have to do it in our own personal life as well. You know, we put the phone down after this conversation and we have to go and do stuff and speak to people and, you know, pay the bills and talk to the authorities and do normal stuff just like everybody else. We all have to do that. So you have to bring that big picture, our spiritual philosophy, right down to the sort of granular level of our own lives. And that's what makes it real. And I agree with your friend who said, you know, spiritual people are no earthly good. They're not if they're always in the other realms. You have to bring it back here and say, well, while I'm here, I'm going to put proper focus on what's here and not just daydream about getting out of here every 10 minutes.
Yeah, I think I told you that story about the yoga teacher. I had a when I had the drowning, the near-death experience, and crossed over, and I was hanging in that plane of bliss for quite a while. It took me a long time to get back, and even to hold things here in the physical world in their form. They kept shifting back into energy and little light particles. It was pretty bizarre. And after taking her class for a while, she was telling me, she says, you know, you need to get a good fat steak and get laid. And this is my yoga
Nice,
teacher telling
nice.
me this, and she said most people are trying to access these higher realms. She said you're trying to get back, and she said you if you don't get grounded, she said you're just going to get, you know, the S kicked out of you basically down here on the planet. You need to get your feet back on the ground, and boy, she was right. You know, I couldn't argue with that.
Well, it's very funny, obviously talking about sexuality and food and stuff, but if you focused on what are the most potentially brilliant physical experiences, you know, you would say, well, food. You know, if you were looking back on your experiences on Earth, you would say, well, sexuality is very interesting. I had some, you know, wonderful, you know, exciting experiences, some intimate experiences, some experiences of union. You know, if you really meet some special people and you're intimate physically and erotically with them. And also food, say, oh boy, you know, what a fantastic food there is on Earth. Unbelievable. You know, the sort of meats and cheeses and vegetables, you know, unbelievable food and drink. And I think it's, you know, it's not by accident if, again, we look back at our spiritual heritage and the texts that we have to look at, that that kind of feasting and the use of particularly red wine in, and I don't just mean in Christian ceremonies, I mean in many ceremonies, Mithraism and so on, those spiritual practices would use all kinds of stuff, not just to alter consciousness and get out of things in, you know, like a state of merriment or whatever, but the other side of it, the reverse, as you say, to bring you back as well, to say if you're like a balloon and you raise your vibration to such a level that you start floating off, you lose balance. And although it's very tempting and lovely, and particularly if you've had a challenging experience like a near-death experience, or a terrible disease, or a loss, you know, an experience of personal grief. It's so tempting in that realm to stay there. Why the hell you'd want to come back? You wouldn't really. And you have to say to yourself, well, I'm going to go back because there's work to be done. Now there's other things that I need to do. And you have to exercise that sort of diligence and spiritual maturity to say, yeah, Earth is hard. It is quite challenging. Struggle sometimes being in the 3D, and yet the training value of it and what I'm learning about balance and other people is invaluable. You know, it's phenomenal training here.
Yeah, it does seem like definitely boot camp, you know, coming down here. And the I know myself, I've had some real challenges in dealing head on with, you know, the authorities and the powers that were, I call them, you know, on the way out. But there does seem to be a huge wave of energy where everybody around the world are being challenged in one way or another to reclaim their power and step back into their God-given, inalienable rights and stand up at once, for themselves and the rest of humanity.
Yeah, and I've noticed that too. And one of the themes, really, I'm going to talk about at the conference over in Ysetti later on next month. Oh, it's this month, in fact, isn't it? Goodness
Yeah,
me!
it
Yeah,
is.
at the end of this month, is the fact that this many of the ideas and thoughts about 2012 and polar shifts and crustal shifts and incoming craft and objects and comets and all these amazing colossal things that would seem so incredibly dramatic to experience on Earth, I think that some of those sort of pale into insignificance compared to some of the internal outpourings that I've already seen in my life and other people's lives, where what wasn't true or what needed to change is like inevitably transforming. You can't help it. And nearly everybody I know is undergoing some sort of huge transition. Most of them very, very challenging, to put it politely. And that's been hard to ignore. And I've started to, notice the correlation between that and this year of potential shift, where that potential isn't about looking for events in distant parts and forests and mysterious zones of the world. It's actually spilling guts in people's own lives all the time. And I'm like, wow, it's kind of an internal phenomena, 2012, as well as the external, which mirrors the internal, as we know. But the internal shifts are massively challenging. And when you acknowledge that, you can almost sit back and say, well, if all the volcanoes go off and the Earth, kind of does a massive freak out and everything's hysterical and, the mountains rise up and the valleys and there's huge tsunamis, that's dramatic, and that's certainly gonna, put the hair up on the back of your neck. But it's not as hard as some of the emotional shifts that I've already been through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They
No,
are more
I know exactly.
challenging.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's like we're having our own internal volcanoes and
Exactly.
tsunamis and earthquakes, and
Yeah,
our
nicely
reality
put.
is just
That's
being
right.
shaken apart right now.
Yeah, it is. And you can't help but notice that. And again, we don't need to go into loads of details, but I know for you, and for me, there's all kinds of shifts. And I've moved house like 50 million times in the past 2 years, and fortunately I have a wonderful relationship with a number of special people, and I've got some great friends, and that certainly makes things a lot easier, because when you get with your sort of tribal members, so to speak, you can stand around with a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or whatever, and share the fact that this story, that this unfoldment, if you pardon my self-publicity, this unfoldment is actually something that is collective. It's something that we're all going through, and to some extent, if you're conscious, and you're particularly sensitive, psychically speaking, it's actually going to be even more challenging. So it doesn't mean it's going to be easier for you. It might even be more difficult, but the rewards in terms of the wisdom that you gain, and like you say, the boot camp aspect of it, are massive. And although on a bad day I might question, the wisdom of it, on most days, on neutral days and on good days, I just think this is actually probably really good for me. And I think I'm getting stronger and smarter and more capable because of all the things that I experience, with other people, and not just in your domestic life, but what goes on politically and things with Obama and Mitt Romney and wars and things happening in Syria and, radical sea changes in the French political spectrum. All these stunning things that go on in the mainstream, and of course, in the esoteric world, in the alternative media, about crafts coming around. Obviously in Mexico we see it a lot, but things in Hungary and Poland, movements of, strange creatures from underground to the surface, channels of, consciousness opening up that haven't been there for a long time. Wherever you look, whatever belief system you choose to adopt, and as you know, I don't think that's necessary at all, but whatever your filters of perception show you're going to see everything in a state of transition. And philosophically speaking, we can say, well, everything always is, isn't it? True. But right now, even the mainstream guys, even the very, very conditioned folks who just kind of watch a lot of TV and do what they're told, even those people can feel it at the moment. Even they can say, well, that old world of, you know, red and blue politics and of old institutions and traditions is kind of going away now. It's kind of disappearing. I don't think we're going to go back to that. And that's not happened for quite a long while. So the old, you know, Thatcher and Reagan politics that we've still been living with for the last 25 years is starting to disappear now.
Mm-hmm. I know. I've talked to a few Qigong masters, and I just had one on the show earlier. What she was saying, that she said she's amazed by how many mainstream people are now coming to her classes. And yeah, she said some people are high-level government people. And she said they're just realizing that their life is just not – it doesn't feed them anymore. It doesn't work. And they're trying to find something else to move into, a different way of living, a different belief system. And, you know, and I'm hearing this all over the place. It's where people are just saying, you know, I just can't do this program anymore. The old program, there's got to be something else out there. And they're kind of stuck between two worlds right now.
Yeah. And it is a sign, isn't it, that when the mainstream people kind of put the hand up and come to people who do this 24/7 and say, hey, you know, you guys seem to know a little bit about this, and you've studied the texts, and you've met with other masters and teachers and trainers, and you've been the student, you've been the teacher, you know, what's a way forward? What has struck me is that how familiar I've become with dealing with people who are mostly very well educated in spiritual matters and have probably done a lot of work and been to, you know, ashrams and temples and read all kinds of books and maybe been doing it 10, 20, 30 years. What's different now is that total newbies, you know, complete entry level freshmen, if you like,
yeah,
are coming knocking on my door saying, hey, what's all this stuff about? Because I think it's important. I think I need to get into it. And they're not kidding. You know, they don't know anything about anything. And yet, it gives me a sort of sense of optimism, really, to say, well, I think that's pretty good, because that spark, although you've buried it for 50 years, hasn't gone out. And you know damn well that this stuff is really what it's all about. This is the game, really, is this spiritual ascendance, which is totally normal and organic and natural. And we've just sort of forgotten about it for the past few thousand years. But it's becoming critical now. And it can be felt in the mainstream, and if you like, a lot of new age and alternative and esoteric language about consciousness and resonance and frequency is starting to go mainstream now. Mm-hmm. And you can flick on the TV set, as I did in a hotel last week, and I'm hearing words on normal network television that 10 years ago you would never hear on television. And the language that we have become familiar and using has started to penetrate the sort of mainstream TV world, and hosts reading teleprompts and scripts that, you know, contain these words like, you know, vibration and consciousness, densities, dimensions. I'm thinking, look at you guys saying that stuff. Oh my gosh, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I noticed when I went down to LA a couple of years ago, and it's kind of sad in two ways. I thought it was great seeing that a lot of people that were very materialistic were now engaging, you know, into the higher conscious energy. Mm. And they had all the buzzwords and they knew what to say and everything. And it became a whole new language down there. But I was really, in a way, I was going, well, that's a step. The next step is being authentic in it, not just doing something because it's fashionable.
But that's frustrating because of who you are and the amount of work you've done. But like you say, I mean, it's important, particularly for people like you and I, to say, well, that's a step. It, you know, it can be frustrating to see people bandy these words around and not really fully understand what they mean and what they infer, and not really to have lived them yet. That can be a little bit frustrating, particularly for me, when I see that, I just think, you know, look at you saying all that stuff, and you don't really get it, and I know that you don't live it. However, you're on the right lines. You've got a lot of work to do, and it can be very fulfilling work. It doesn't need to be hard, unpleasant work. It can be juicy and wonderful and very edifying. But yeah, that's a step, and I think that's a very humbling thing for me personally, is not to allow myself to get too frustrated about how slow some people are. Mm-hmm. At least the sort of trying, you know, it's like seeing people in church or in the temple, in the mosque or the, you know, synagogue or whatever. You can be forgiven sometimes for thinking, goodness me, you know, you're in the wrong place. Go and get your own divinity, you know, you don't need it mediated through priests. However, at least they're trying, you know, at least they have some element of spirituality, however thin it may be and however second-hand it might be, at least there's something there of value. And those people, one would hope, might eventually have the courage to take that up themselves and evolve it to the next level. I'd rather to some extent see that than the total atheist or whatever who says there's nothing, it's just a big clockwork, cold, dark place and there's nothing going on. I think that even Orthodox religion has some clues in it, and there's some you know, kind of analogies and metaphors there that are valuable. Mm-hmm. And I know several people who have started off in various religious backgrounds, Methodist, Presbyterian, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, all different kinds of things. Very Orthodox Jewish lady I was speaking to a couple of months ago, and they have seen some value in what they do, and they've taken it forward and slightly started to detach themselves from their spiritual origins, if you like, from their religious traditions. Mm-hmm. But not dropping the religion and saying, oh, this is all nonsense and I'm just going to become an atheist. They've done the reverse, which is advance it and take it to the next level and say, actually, this is a very personal journey. I think that the connection with divinity is very personal, because we, in fact, ourselves are an emanation of that divinity. And when that hits people, then suddenly they can appreciate some of the things they've learned for the past 30 or 40 years, and they don't have to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. Me, myself, I've had a very Christian upbringing, and I went to a Church of England school as a child and stuff. And there were some okay things about it, you know. I mean, I had to do a lot of work to scrub out some of the nonsense, but
yeah,
some of the principles of it have actually still presented themselves as being quite useful. But you need a lot of discernment, you know, to get to that point. So, you know, it's there's always something of value in most religious systems.
I know in the meditations, a lot of times the higher masters talk about how we have to transcend all religious and cultural boundaries to get, you know, into unity consciousness, you know, where you see God in everything and everything. And I think the hardest part is actually to see God in yourself.
Yeah, I do as well, because people, there's a taboo against that. And, you know, another British philosopher, you know, someone I've really admired for a while, Alan Watts, he used to say, I mean, he was dead when I was a little kid, but he used to say in the sort of 60s and 70s that, you know, the taboo against knowing what you are, you know, he wrote this book called The Book, you know, the taboo against knowing who and what you are. Mm-hmm. It's like there is a divinity there, and some traditions, like strangely enough Mormonism, will to some degree acknowledge that and say, yeah, part of the path is to acknowledge and realize the divinity within you and move back to your source, move back home in a way. And I kind of like that.
Yeah.
But the orthodoxy that came later after Smith with Brigham Young and stuff, it changed radically and it became something very different. Still value there, but it's getting more and more removed from the original core belief, I think, which is a personal observation, not any sort of orthodoxy or whatever. And so in Christian mainstream theology, though, to suggest that we are God is heresy. And in Catholicism, to suggest that you are God is heresy to some extent. And not long ago, I mean, you and I would have been set on fire for suggesting that.
Yeah. Well, I noticed, you know, even, you know, if you really want to use the teachings of Jesus, basically, you know, he said, you know, the Father and I are one. and he said, "I am God." And that really shook him up, and I think that was one of the reasons they nailed him on the cross. But you know, it's just a pattern. He laid down a pattern where he began by saying, you know, "I'm the Son of Man." He was the son of Joseph and Mary, and that was his identity. And then later on he said, "I'm a messenger of God," which is, you know, he was delivering messages. Spirit was speaking through him. And then later on he said, "Wait a second, I'm not this personality and this body. I'm a spirit. I came from God. I came from the source. I'm the Son of God." And then later, total immersion, he totally became one with the one consciousness, you know, that encompasses all consciousness, and said, "I am, you know, the Father and I are one. You know, I am God." And people mistake that for him saying that he is the God and only God. He's not saying that when he said it. He's showing us a path that all of us can do. And
it's funny, you get the feeling, don't you, that if Jesus was deciding to come back for his second coming or whatever, he's going to be pretty pissed that his words have been so massively distorted. And the first people who are going to get a kick up the backside are the Christian Orthodoxy, who I believe, you know, it's a great example of what we were saying earlier, where there is a lot of value in this guy, Jesus, this figure of Christ. There is a lot of value in some of the teachings of this individual, and it's often in the Gospels that were left out of the canonical Bible, that didn't make it in the 17th century King James cut, shall we say, where there's some astonishing wisdom. And as anyone who knows my stuff, you know, reading the Nag Hammadi tractates, which is Christian work in a way, but it's Gnostic work. It's shamanic indigenous knowledge from various lands, from the East, from Gaul, from France, from different places, wrapped up in Christian theology to some degree to protect people. Because as we said, if you said the wrong thing, really, in the last 2,000 years, you could be killed for it. And it's only very recently that that's changed, very recently, in the last 200 or 300 years. Before that, they were still burning people in Europe for heresy and witchcraft and so on. But in those Gospels, in the Gnostic Gospels, Christ comes across as a very sophisticated teacher of consciousness and of spiritual development, and a totally different character than what you would get certainly from the New Testament, but even also from the Old Testament, where, you know, some of the more core knowledges, I believe, some of the Judaic transcriptions of that. But in the Gnostic Gospels, it's much more pure, and you could almost say, yeah, this guy might have been just a super, you know, advanced, brilliant avatar to come back, help humanity, raise the game a bit. And he came to these amazing realizations, and he was just a super, super guy, you know, really amazing. And he shared his knowledge, and then at some point somebody said, "Oh my gosh, we can't have this. We can't have human beings being brilliant and powerful and loving and compassionate and full of vigor and full of spiritual dynamism. So what we'll do is we'll make Jesus the God." And it's a very clever way of diverting people's attention, as you say, from themselves, which is where the God is.
I've always told people, unfortunately, a lot of Christianity is one of the most disempowering programs I've ever seen, where everything is done outside of yourself. I mean, you either blame God or the devil for everything good or bad in your life, or you ask, you know, Jesus to do everything for you. And, you know, where's the self-empowerment or you know, individual responsibility for, you know, us basically living in an action-reaction world, you know, known as the plane of demonstration, where consciousness creates reality. It's so basic. But that this other program totally disempowers you and you know, leaves you as this wretched sinner, you know, in this very low form of existence that, you know, you have to give your power away and your cash and everything else to somebody else to take away all the judgments they're laying upon you, you know, which, you know, the funny thing to me is I got to say this. In my own experience, my own near-death experience and experiencing what I call the source or whatever, it didn't have an ego. It didn't have a form. It wasn't male. It wasn't female. It couldn't judge. And that's what people get hung up on. They've personified God in their own image, not realizing that it's so far beyond that. And even Jesus said, neither do I judge thee, nor does my Father judge thee. He's trying to tell people, look, God is beyond that. It's beyond the little old man with a beard with a laptop, taking notes, getting ready to punish you with a lightning bolt or.
Oh, he's been upgraded to having a laptop now, has he?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
So, it's interesting that having that experience to me just shocked me out of that old programming. But we all have that in us. We all have been programmed with this heaven and hell polarity consciousness, and that we're usually on the bottom of the rung, trying to climb our way up, and hopefully somebody will throw us a bone.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? That when you accept personal responsibility for your own spiritual truth and path and progression and your mistakes and flaws and triumphs and, splendors, accepting responsibility for that is quite a big thing. And it's much easier just to think, well, forget that. I'll just go to confession, or I'll go and, put a wafer in my mouth, or I'll kneel and pray and just absolve myself in one way or another, and my responsibility is disavowed because I go to church every Sunday, and I go to Bible discussion groups on Wednesdays, and I do this and I do that. And you say, well, you put in effort into it, and yet if you place your responsibility outside of yourself, as you say, James, that is a mistake, because I would pretty much bet, that the divine, shall we say, who obviously isn't any sort of humanoid, doesn't have a gender, there's no genitals involved in divinity, I don't think, that divine source is completely interested in people who determine for themselves and who demonstrate their own free will, which is a divine thing, and who demonstrate their own sovereignty, which is a divine thing. And in a way, only when you accept your own divine authority do you respect the divine, I feel. I think it's disrespectful to just believe that there's this book that had all this wisdom beamed into it from a divine God. I think that's unacceptable anymore. I don't think we can really hand on heart say that's the way it is. It isn't the word of God. It's the word of men who are interested in God, and it's the word of people who have had experiences and visions and apocalypses, that being the true definition of that. That's what the Bible is. But to say it's the word of God is absolutely necessary if you want to be a faithful worshiper, and that's the problem.
I always tell people that's where bluebirds came from, because they God actually dipped the prophets in ink and hand wrote through the prophets his own words, and
I know, I
you
know.
know it, I always tell people just use logic, it these are the are men doing the best they can with the references and the understandings they had, trying to explain experiences.
Yeah.
And in the past, and some of them did a pretty good job of it, and some of them didn't really have the reference points to truly understand what was happening to them.
Yeah, and it's fair enough, isn't it? And we can be kind of respectful about that and say, well, it isn't a guy in a chair with a beard. We know that. And yet, if you'd had a very powerful experience 2,000 years ago about this supreme being, you're going to naturally anthropomorphize it into something a bit like you. Everybody does that. We all prefer what's a bit like us, and we can understand that. So I think it's relevant to say, people who have done a lot of spiritual work and a lot of reading and a lot of study and a lot of practice and been on many journeys, it's notable how they do not throw out Christian and Jewish and Muslim texts. We don't throw them away because there's some valuable material there. What we have to do is learn how to decode it, basically, and not fall for silly fundamentalist orthodoxy, because it's not meant to be taken literally. The Bible is not meant to be literal. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of describing something. It's, as the Zen guys would say, it's the finger pointing at the moon. Don't look at the bloody finger. Look at what it's pointing at.
Yeah, that's a good one. I know I always use that classic example of Ezekiel, where he sees a shiny disc coming out of the firmament, and it has bronze feet like calves, and fire and brimstone coming out from underneath it. And when it lands, It sounds like a thousand rushing rivers. And then after it lands, these other little objects come out of it, which were wheels within wheels with flashing lights all around them. Now, in this old superstitious and without the reference points, that would how we would explain it, that we would probably say this is God, coming down and landing. And but nowadays, when we look at it, we go, wow, that's a ship, it's got it's a disc, it's a shiny disc, it's got landing legs, bronze, look like bronze landing legs coming down. It has some kind of a propulsion system that looks like bright light or fire and brimstone coming out from underneath it. It might be dropping off something, some sparks or whatever, and it sounds like a thousand rushing rivers when it lands. And to me, that's a very clear example
It
of an
is.
experience that they had in ancient history that they tried to explain with the reference points that they had.
It is, and that principle is the same today. We have to do that all the time, and that's why we've got to be so careful not to throw things out just because we've found an enriching path and it's full of wisdom and real personal experiences, and you can stand there and you can see these physical things in front of you. Just because we've had that, and we're not really in any position to scoff people who go to church every Sunday because they're also studying something of value. But it's just a question of reframing what that is, I think. And there is a lot of wisdom in Christian theology, but you have to take a very deep and broad and discerning view of it.
Yeah, we had a I just recently did a clearing with a guy, and very Catholic, tradition, everything, but he's having all these incredible experiences and trying to figure them out. And he says, there's something in church, it just doesn't work for me, but all these people gather and these women start crying and they feel the presence of Jesus and an amazing experience. And I said, well, you can have a spiritual experience in it within a religious format. I mean, that is a possibility, but you really won't have a religious experience in the spiritual format. And so I said, they're probably two or more gathering, they're setting their intent. They're having an incredible experience. The problem with that is other people are trying to own that and cash in on it, and that's where I think it goes awry.
It is, and it's like we said, it's if the best space that you've created for yourself, and maybe we can, round up the interview with this, but if the space that you've created for yourself, if the best you can do is say, well, it's in the church on a Sunday, okay, it's better than nothing. But it is nice to say to people, but there's some really great news because that space can be created in an even deeper way, in an even more sincere way in terms of a channel to the divine, any way you want, and particularly in your own personal way. It doesn't have to be here in this temple that is organized in a very depersonalized way and in a very unhealthy way, I'm sad to say, many times, not always, but many times. And so to give people the idea that that special thing that you can create here, where there are these tears of revelation sometimes, and some miracles do happen on a personal and collective level. That's not localized and specific to this place. That's just something that you're doing here. You can do it anywhere.
Yeah, that's definitely important. So, as far as getting hold of your new book and actually getting more information, what's the best way for people to contact you?
Okay, if you go to neilkramer.com, and that's Kramer with a K, NEILKRAMER, neilkramer.com, you'll see a picture of the book cover, the unfoldment, just right there on the right-hand side. Click on that, and that'll give you a description of what it is, what it's about, and also the different places you can buy it. Obviously, the big online retailers that everybody knows about, many bookstores as well, physically. And also DVDs and audiobooks and so on, and my teaching work. And last but by no means least, events such as the Global Transformation Conference in the last weekend of June 2012.
Yeah, and they can email us. They can just go to eseti.org and email us if they want more information on that. It's not up on the site But if you just ask, for more information, we'll send you all the information on that. But, again, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's been awesome as usual, and we miss you here, and can't wait to see you at the end of June.
Awesome, James. I look forward to spending some quality time with you guys and giving my very best to your audience at the conference.
Great. Give Marin a big hug for us too.
I will do, sir. All right, you take care, and I'll speak to you soon.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, this is James Gilliland signing off, your host. Have a great day and create your own sacred space and make your own personal contact with the source. Have a good night.